From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. The late John Cassavetes has been called the father of independent film. Five of his films made outside the studio system are now on DVD. They are Shadows, Faces, A Woman Under the Influence, The Killing of a Chinese Bookie, and Opening Night. On today's Fresh Air, we feature interviews with actress Jenna Rollins, his wife and collaborator who starred in many of his films, and with actor Peter Falk, who also worked with Cassavetes. And critic John Powers reviews the new DVD set. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews Kinsey, starring Liam Neeson as Dr. Alfred Kinsey, who conducted the first scientific studies on human sexual behavior. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. In the West Bank, tens of thousands of mourners overwhelmed security officials as Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat was buried today in his headquarters, known as the Makada. The BBC's Lucy Williamson reports from Ramallah.
Gunfire and chanting to greet their leader as the body of Yasser Arafat returned to the Makada aboard an Egyptian helicopter. 10,000 Palestinians surged forward to reclaim it. Chants of God is great drowned out the military band as Palestinian security forces struggled to take the coffin, draped in the Palestinian flag, the few short meters to the burial site. Hours earlier, the crowd massing in the streets outside defied security guards to storm the Makada, streaming over the walls to fill the compound ahead of the coffin's arrival.
The BBC's Lucy Williamson in Ramallah. Bush administration sources say that Rod Paige will resign as education secretary. Paige, who's 71, was the first African-American to lead the Department of Education. He came to the job after serving as the superintendent of schools in Houston, Texas. He was an advocate for President Bush's No Child Left Behind law and defended it against criticism that it amounted to an unfunded mandate. Page's relations with teachers' unions deteriorated during his tenure, and he once referred to the nation's largest teachers' union as a terrorist organization. American troops moved farther into the Iraqi city of Fallujah today. The Marine Corps commander of the assault said U.S. and Iraqi forces now control some 80% of the city. NPR's Eric Westervelt has more from the Pentagon.
The Marine commander in Fallujah, Lieutenant General John Sattler, says dangerous house-to-house fights continue as U.S. forces continue to find weapons caches and strong pockets of resistance. Five U.S.-trained Iraqi fighters have been killed and another 40 injured so far, he said, with the U.S. toll much higher.
We have lost 22 coalition warriors who made the ultimate sacrifice, and approximately 170 have been wounded.
Sattler estimated that some 600 insurgent fighters have been killed. He said it's less clear how many Iraqi civilians have died in the assault. Amnesty International Friday expressed deep concern over civilian casualties, charging that neither side has taken the necessary precautions to protect civilians on the battlefield. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, The Pentagon.
A California jury has convicted Scott Peterson of murdering his pregnant wife, Lacey, and the fetus she was carrying. The verdicts came after a trial that made tabloid headlines for 5 months. Peterson was found guilty of first-degree murder in the death of his wife and second-degree murder in the death of the fetus. He could face execution or life in prison when the penalty phase takes place later this month. In stocks, the Dow was up 69 to 10,539. The Nasdaq was up 24 to 2085. This is NPR News. The Commerce Department says retail sales were up slightly in October and business inventories were nearly flat the month before. NPR's Paul Brown has details.
Retail sales account for two-thirds of U.S. economic activity, so economists watch these numbers carefully. The government says that in October, sales rose just 0.2% from September. A drop in car sales after a hot month in September with end-of-model-year incentives was largely responsible for trimming the overall growth in retail sales. If car sales had held their own in October, retail sales would have been up by 0.9%, with many sectors showing strong performance. And the total figure for October is still 7.5% above a year ago. The Commerce Department also reported business inventories rose by a mere 0.1% in September. Businesses had enough goods in stock on average to last them about 1.3 months. That was unchanged from August. Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Attorney General John Ashcroft said today that federal judges are putting the nation at risk by ruling against some of President Bush's decisions on the war. Ashcroft, who announced on Tuesday that he plans to step down, told a conservative lawyers group that what he called intrusive judicial oversight was undermining national security in a time of war. He was referring to federal judges' decisions challenging the military prosecutions of prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. This week, a federal judge prevented a military commission from trying a Yemeni man accused of being Osama bin Laden's driver. The judge said a competent authority must decide whether the defendant is entitled to the international treaty protections accorded to a prisoner of war. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Warner Home Video, presenting The West Wing, the complete third season, on DVD, featuring a documentary with former presidents and their staffs.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, in for Terry Gross. John Cassavetes died 15 years ago, but his reputation keeps growing. He's best known to many people as an actor, especially for movies like Rosemary's Baby. But his most important work was as a groundbreaking filmmaker. Now a new Criterion DVD box set of 8 discs, including 5 of his movies, has just been released. On today's show, we'll hear from Peter Falk, who worked extensively with Cassavetes, and Jenna Rollins, who starred in several of his films and in real life played the role of his wife. But first, our critic at large, John Powers, explores what made Cassavetes unique.
I was maybe 15 when I saw my first film by John Cassavetes. It was a story about troubled marriage called Faces, and it scared me. It scared me because I wasn't ready to handle such intense emotion. But it also scared me because I didn't get it. In its flailing characters and drawn-out scenes, it wasn't remotely like the movies I'd seen. I was hardly the only one to find Cassavetes a challenge, maybe even a threat. Decades later, most Americans still haven't seen his work, or discovered that once you leave our native shores, John Cassavetes is regarded as a world-class filmmaker, a name to be put alongside Godard, Bergman, or Hitchcock. All that may change with Criterion's new box of 5 Cassavetes films, which is less a DVD compilation than a cultural event, complete with discs documenting his career and a booklet of critical essays. The package covers the stages of Cassavetes' work, from his 1959 debut Shadows, which tackled race and romance in ways that today's filmmakers would still find too daring, to Opening Night, his masterful 1977 study of an actress confronting age and alcohol. In between, we get Faces, the schizophrenic love story A Woman Under the Influence, and the wonderfully titled The Killing of a Chinese Bookie, starring Ben Gazzara as a strip club owner with illusions of elegance. Whether pockmarked or crazy or just downright annoying, not a single character in any of these films would feel at home in a Hollywood movie. In fact, from the beginning, Cassavetes' career was a rebuke to the Hollywood Dream Factory, with its glossy production values and glossed-over humanity. He wasn't interested in technique or neatly crafted storylines. He was interested in confused, often unenlightened people, especially those who've somehow been knocked off their bearings and are madly struggling to regain some sort of equilibrium. In trying to capture the emotional truth of such characters, Cassavetes put his ultimate faith in actors. He believed that they, more than anyone else, take us close to human feeling, which he saw as an absolute value. You get a hint of this in the following scene from Opening Night, in which an actress, played by Cassavetes' wife, Jenna Rollins, discusses her latest stage role with the playwright.
Listen, Sarah, every playwright writes a play about herself. You've written a play about aging. Well, I'm not your age.
What is your age?
I'm aware that playing an older woman is part of my problem. I have no illusions about being a teenager. But, you know, on stage you have Virginia having hot flashes. So I don't have hot flashes. I'm not going through menopause. I'm not ready to play grandmothers yet. You know, you're very clever. If I'm good at this part, my career is severely limited.
Limited to what?
Once you're convincing in a part, the audience accepts you as that.
As what?
As old, that's what, old.
Are you gonna quit?
No. I'm looking for a way to play this part where age doesn't make any difference. Age isn't interesting. Age is depressing. Age is dull. Age doesn't have anything to do with anything. Listen, Sarah, I don't have a husband. I don't have a family. This is it for me. I mean, I get my kicks out of acting. If I can reach a woman sitting in the audience who thinks that nobody understands anything and my character goes through everything that she's going through, well, I feel like I've done a good job.
Cassavetes' work is all about capturing the truth of emotion, but his movies aren't realistic in any conventional sense. They often feel feverish, over the top, concerned with the feelings behind the feelings we let ourselves express. As critic Michael Ventura once observed, regular movies have their actors occupy the center of their characters' emotions in the way that, say, Julie Andrews sings a song like My Favorite Things. In contrast, Cassavetes' actors are always ferociously exploring the farthest reaches of an emotion, the way that, say, John Coltrane takes the melody of My Favorite Things and then stretches it to the breaking point. Cassavetes pushes toward intensity not as an end in itself, but to reveal something deeper than mere emotion. The soul, in all its wounded dignity. Now, to be honest, you have to be in the mood to see a Cassavetes picture. He didn't make crowd pleasers. He even said he hated entertainment. And because his movies were built around acting, they have weird rhythms and sometimes feel redundant, even when they contain an epical performance, like Roland's work in A Woman Under the Influence. And that's not all. Out of sheer cussedness, he was known to re-edit his movies to make them less likable and more challenging. "The audience is going to hate this," he once cackled while shooting. "But screw them if they can't take a joke." In the end, Cassavetes' greatness is inseparable from the fact that his films were always so nakedly and proudly personal. We hear countless words these days about independent filmmakers, but Cassavetes was and remains the gold standard of independence. He launched the indie movement with Shadows, used his acting to finance his filmmaking, free of outside interference, and he even shot in his own house. Unlike so many indie filmmakers who can't wait to sign on with the studios, he stayed the distance. Until his death in 1989, he tirelessly pursued his own vision, a vision rooted in his compassionate feeling for the lost human soul. Cassavetes knew that all human beings share one thing in common. We're lonely and frightened and looking for love.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and media columnist for LA Weekly. Jenna Rollins was John Cassavetes' favorite actress, and they were married and had four children together. Rollins starred in several of his films, including A Woman Under the Influence, A Child is Waiting, Faces, Minnie and Moskowitz, and Gloria. In 1996, she starred in Unhook the Stars, directed by her son, Nick Cassavetes. Most recently, she appeared in Taking Lives and The Notebook. Terry spoke with Rollins in 1996. Before we hear that interview, let's listen to a scene from A Woman Under the Influence, made in 1974. Rollins plays a suburban housewife with three kids who's having an emotional breakdown. Her husband loves her, but is worried sick about what's happening to her. He's played by Peter Falk.
You're going to be committed. Go on to the hospital until you get better.
I'm not sore at you. I mean, you hit me. You never did that before. I feel that, if that's what you feel bad about. I always understood you, and you always understood me, and it was always just how it was, and that's it. Till death do us part, Nick, you said it. Remember, he said, do you, Mabel Mortensen, take this man? I do, Nick. I do. Remember, I said, it's gonna work because I'm already pregnant.
Don't let that mind run away on you now.
Do you remember how you laughed?
Don't, Mabel.
Nick, you laughed. Don't you remember? And he was so mad as a big toad.
Don't do that.
Hey, don't be sad. I know you love me.
A Woman Under the Influence, directed by your late husband, John Cassavetes. You played a woman married to a character played by Peter Falk. And you're having a nervous breakdown, and you just, unravel more and more as the movie goes on. Had you seen somebody going through that before taking on the role, somebody who you could think about while doing the movie?
Not one person. I wasn't thinking of one person, but I have seen people who so loved another person that it became an obligation to the other person. It wasn't a wonderful thing, and the person who loved too much developed nothing else in her life, so that when that love was withdrawn from her, that she had nothing to fall back on. I have seen that several times.
And how did you use that in the movie?
Well, just you think you study your part. I mean, just the way you would think that you do. A part is like reading a detective story. You are presented with you don't write it. You don't start it in the middle. You interpret it, and very often you find things that they're doing. The character that you're doing that puzzles you, and you wonder how and why, and so you take as much of, because I believe that all of us have every quality, all of us. It's a matter of degree, and acting is a matter of increasing the degree or decreasing, but it's always there, and you can always find it inside of you. It's just a matter, very often, of just sitting for quite a long time and thinking about things. And if, when you come to something that is extremely puzzling, to figure it out and think about things that you've seen and heard and people you've known. And all you need is just a little bit. It can be like a little piece of rice. But once you have the feeling, then you can enlarge it and take it where you wish to.
You and your late husband, John Cassavetes, were making independent films before I think there was even a name for it. I mean, you were,
yes.
You were,
yes,
really pioneers of that in the movie industry. Why did you start? Why did you start finding your own little niche away from the larger industry?
Well, of course, as you say, you don't think of yourself as a pioneer, or even you don't think of yourself in any particular way. It's just that you want to express a different kind of story, a different kind of... we felt that there's so much more that could be said on film, and that films could be much more personal to the audience, that you could do pictures that were actually something that people would relate to because it was in their own lives. Because all of them really, essentially, are about love and the loss of love, or how to survive love, or how to find love, or how to keep love, or you know what you do with it, which is really the eternal problem for all of us. And we thought it could be shown in a more natural setting, a more accessible way. Rather than just say an action film or
a glamorous romance
escape film, but it's not that we wanted them to stop doing that kind of film. We just felt that there was a lot of room for a lot of kinds of film.
Jenna Rollins speaking with Terry Gross in 1996. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1996 interview with actress Jenna Rollins.
Could you describe a little bit about what the guidelines for improvisation were within the films that you made with John Cassavetes. How much improvisation was there? What were the parameters for that?
The first film that he made, Shadows, was entirely improvised. I wasn't in that. And so then he did develop a reputation from that as doing everything improvisationally. But actually, after that, he always had a script. And, you know, not just a thrown-together script, a real script. But then when we would have, if you'd have a problem with a scene, or John's theory was that if he got a bunch of good actors together and there was a problem, that it was the writer's problem. So then we would stop and we'd talk about it, rehearse, improvise, work about it as much as we needed to. And then when we thought we had it, he'd go in and sit down and write the scene from the improvisation the way he wanted it. And that's how we did most of them. Not all of them. There were lots of improvisations all the way through to the last films that we made. But mainly they were very scripted.
And so even the parts that were improvised, by the time you did the final take, it had been scripted based on the improvisation.
Mostly. I was thinking of one that is just the opposite of that. In our last picture, Love Streams, I played a woman who loved too much, loved her husband too much, loved her children too much. I did everything too much. I carried too much luggage. And I believed that love was a stream that could never, ever stop. And this I believed in spite of the fact that my husband just couldn't stand me. And my child was just right along his side because she just drove everybody crazy with her excessiveness. It says in the script that she calls the husband home from a business meeting and the child home from school because she knows that they are not getting enough fun out of life. And that they are wasting their time with this sort of thing. So they come home thinking something important is happening. And then there's just this one little sentence, really. And it said, they come home and sit down, she makes them laugh. And I said, what does that mean, John? And how does she make them laugh? He said, don't worry about it. He said, I've got something great planned. You're going to love it. And I said, well, but... do you have any hints or anything? He said, no. He said, I don't want to ruin it for you. He said, just wait. And I said, this is making me hysterical. And he said, no, I'm telling you. He said, I don't want to even give it away. So we got to the day that we were going to shoot, and he said, stay in the dressing room. I don't want you to see the preparations. And I really was truly hysterical. And finally he came and said, okay, he said, now come on out. And we were shooting in the backyard of this beautiful home, and there was Seymour Cassell and Risa Blewett, who were playing my husband and child, and they're both sitting there. And they had a long picnic table, and on top of the picnic table there were about 100 of those, you know, those crazy little games that you see, you know, those clattering, chattering false teeth and eyes that pop out on springs and catch your bottles that look like they're getting stuff all of you, all that terrible, those joke store games. And John said, there, what do you think? I said, what do you mean, what do I think? Well, what am I supposed to do here? He said, make them laugh. I said, with these, I said, which ones? He said, all of them. He said, we've got a minute to shoot it. He said, and use every one, make them laugh, and then go jump off the diving board into the pool. So I said, well, shall we rehearse? He said, no. He said, I don't want to ruin the spontaneity of it. He said, okay, roll them. And so I just wildly started, you know, with the eyes and the ketchup and the thing. And of course, he had already told them not to laugh because in their characters, they were not amused that they'd been brought home, you know. And so now I got wilder and wilder, trying, you know, just anything to that. Finally, the minute had gone by, and I went and jumped off the diving board. Then, of course, I realized why I was jumping off the diving board, because he had it planned that they weren't going to laugh. Now, that kind of improvisation was quite rare because there was no rehearsal, there was no talking, there was nothing. It was just, you just went for it. And he, you know, he was right. It was more fun to do that scene. It's when I look back on it with a lot of happiness.
Your father, I believe, was a state senator when you were growing up. Do I have that
yes.
right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
In Wisconsin. In Wisconsin. And this was U.S. Senate? Oh, state senate,
no,
right,
no,
in the state senate.
No, state senate, Progressive okay. Party, which doesn't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It was the La Follette Party.
Huh.
And working within a state, you can really get quite a lot done for your state. And I think he enjoyed it.
Did you ever have to be the model daughter while your father was in politics, or is that also too far in the past to remember?
Well, I was not a hard child because I was a sick child. I was an invalid when I was little, and so, you know, I wasn't much of a handful. I was lying around looking pale and reading books and things. My immune system probably was just not very developed, and because when I got to be a teenager, I'd never been sick again. And so I don't know. It was just one thing after another, but they were all very kind of serious things, asthma and all of those things. But then they just all kind of magically went away, so I think something just kicked in.
Were you very unhappy during the period that you were sick?
No, I wasn't. I would like to have gone to school more in that sense, but I always was very happy reading. And everybody, you know, when you have a sickly kid, everybody's awfully nice to you. And they probably would have been anyway. But my mother would, in order to make me eat anything, she would go to all kind of extremes. I remember one time, I wouldn't eat carrots. I wouldn't eat anything yellow. So she cut a carrot into the shape of a goldfish, and with a long tail. And then she put it in a goldfish bowl with water in it, and she came into where I was sick, and she said, "I have an uncontrollable urge." She said, "I can't stand it. I've got to eat this goldfish. I've got to do it. I'm going to." I said, no, don't do it." She said, "I've got to, unless you'll eat this carrot." And so I said, "Oh, all right." You know? But they would go to the most extraordinary kind of creative lengths to do these things for me. I really had a pretty happy childhood.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
It was.
Jenna Rollins, speaking with Terry Gross in 1996. She was married to John Cassavetes and starred in many of his films, including Faces and Gloria. A new box set of Cassavetes films is out now. We'll hear more from another actor who worked extensively with him, Peter Falk, in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Mark Summers' new illustrated edition of poems and tales by Edgar Allan Poe, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com, from TIAA Cref, providing a wide selection of individual retirement solutions, tiaacref.org/radio, and by the Alzheimer's Association, encouraging Americans to learn about ways to reduce the risk of Alzheimer's disease on the web at alz.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, actor Peter Falk on working with John Cassavetes and on his role as Columbo, the rumpled, deceptively casual detective. There's also a new DVD of the first season of Columbo. And David Edelstein reviews the new film Kinsey about Dr. Alfred Kinsey, who pioneered studies on human sexual behavior. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley. Peter Falk is famous worldwide for portraying one of television's most iconic characters, Lieutenant Columbo, the detective with a tattered raincoat, a sharp mind, and a very persistent nature. Falk has been playing Columbo off and on since 1968. We'll hear Falk discussing his Columbo character later in the show, but right now we'll hear about his film work with John Cassavetes. Falk co-starred in The Director's Husbands and A Woman Under the Influence and was well-suited to the wide range of comedy and drama and the various levels of improvisation that those parts demanded. Terry spoke with Peter Falk in 1995 and asked him about working with Cassavetes.
What struck you as different about his approach to directing than what you were used to?
Everything. Everything John did was original. Everything. Every bone in his body was original. He was the most fertile man I've ever met. I'll never meet anyone as fertile as he was. I mean, he's changed the face of filmmaking and in every way, not only in form, but in content, everything. John was something. John saw the dawn about 2 hours before everybody else. John's first picture was called Faces. I think he made it in 56, maybe 57. And that was maybe 10 years before anybody ever heard of Martin Luther King. Now, there's John. He's 25 years old. He's making his first picture. And the theme of it has to do with a black and white relationship, male, female, black, white. He was ahead of his time, John.
When you improvise with Cassavetes in a movie, what was the process of improvisation like?
There's much less improvisation in his movies than people think. I could make a lot of money if I would bet somebody. I said, you point out the scenes to me that are improvised, and when you're wrong, you pay me, and when you're right, I'll pay you. You can't tell the difference between what's improvised and what isn't improvised in John's scenes. John introduced a new standard of spontaneity, a new standard of spontaneous behavior in acting. Nobody did that before. He started that. There were times when John would want you to improvise. There were other times where it was strictly written and you were expected to follow the script.
Working with Cassavetes, did that bring out a certain spontaneity in you?
If it did. If it took me a long time to trust him. Because actors, we have our own idea about how we act. And you rely on... technique has a lot to do with acting. Technique has a lot to do with the craft of acting. And that's the one thing John didn't want. I mean, he didn't want you to be technical, even in the best sense. You can get an actor who's an extremely capable technical actor, and nobody can tell the difference.
What strikes me with Cassavetes' movies, one of the many things that make them different, is that there's a lot more, everything's slower, there's more space around actions and words. A lot of movies, especially now, are so tightly edited and so quickly paced. But, you know, there's silences and pauses and just a lot of room, and I was wondering if that made it made you pace yourself differently in a performance, knowing that the camera was going to be on you maybe for a longer time, and in moments that to another director might seem like an off moment and not an on moment.
Yeah, that's the one thing John never wanted you to think about, and the way he directed prevented you from thinking about that, whether or not you are going to take more space or whether you're going to take less space or whether this scene called for whatever, this kind of mood or that kind of mood. He was trying to get you to get rid of all that crap. Just behave. Behave. Let me worry about it later on. And then he would cut the scene. But while you were doing it, he wouldn't let you do that. He'd put a banana up his ass and run around in front of you. He'd do anything to make you off balance.
Did he actually do that?
Oh, he did worse.
Oh.
He would do anything. He would do anything to stop you from thinking. He would do anything to stop you from trying to figure out, how am I going to do this? And he would never tell you anything. And the reason he wouldn't tell you anything was because he was afraid of words. He was afraid that those words would then be retranslated into some cliché.
Well, why wouldn't he tell you? He didn't want you thinking.
He didn't want you thinking. And if you start talking about what the character is feeling, you do have that danger of saying, oh, I understand now. This is how you play embarrassment. And you play it the way you've seen somebody else play it, or you have some idea of how to play it. And what usually happens is that the behavior lacks the ambiguity that most behavior has, where it's not just, there are different kinds of anger, there are different kinds of charm. They're not all the same, and there's mixtures involved at any given moment in time. And I think that's why the behavior in his picture is, to me at any rate, more interesting. So he wouldn't tell you anything.
So this threw you off balance, having technique taken away from you.
Yes. And I was off balance, and I was irritated, and I was angry, and I was afraid, and I was nervous. I was all those things.
Was there a turning point where you started to think, oh, I get it now, I can make this work, or I could work within this kind of...
I didn't get to that. I didn't really get to that turning point. Actually, we'd finished Husbands, and I was still uncertain. And the reason I did Woman Under the Influence is because I looked in a mirror once, and I said to myself, you know, you might be wrong, Peter. He might be right. I'm going to try it again. And that's why I made Woman Under the Influence. I wanted to go again with him. Just to see.
And what changed for you in that film?
Well, I trusted him even more, and I understood a little bit more about the way he was trying to do things. That was John's problem. Nobody could understand why he was trying to do it. He had to break everybody down. And he did. And it was good that he did. And he was able to do it.
Peter Falk, speaking to Terry Gross in 1995. We'll continue the interview in a moment, and when we do, he'll talk about Columbo. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with actor Peter Falk, who played Lieutenant Columbo, one of the most famous characters in the history of television, right up there with Ralph Cramden, Lucy Ricardo, and Archie Bunker. But Peter Falk's character was, and is, different. Those other characters all came from sitcoms. Columbo's equally quirky character was the central figure in a mystery drama, and that character has clocked more years on TV than Ralph, Lucy, and Archie combined. The first season of Columbo, including the 1968 prescription murder telemovie that introduced the character, has just been released on DVD by Universal. Here's a scene from Prescription Murder with some of Columbo's now famous mannerisms already in evidence.
Well, listen, there's one more thing. You don't remember what your wife was wearing that night, do you?
Well, Carol had so many dresses. Is it important?
Well, yes, in a way it is.
Let's see now. Oh, yes, she was wearing a blue wool dress with brass buttons, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's what the stewardess said. She's back in town, by the way, and I spoke to her, and she told me your wife was wearing a blue wool dress with blue kid gloves.
Well, and that's probably it.
That's funny, though. If she came home from the airport, what did she do with the dress and gloves? When we went over your apartment last week, we couldn't find them.
Well, they may have been stolen.
Yeah, maybe. Did you put those on the list of stolen items?
Really, Lieutenant, how could you expect me to notice they were missing?
Still, it's puzzling when you think about it. I mean, why would a guy steal a dress and a pair of gloves? What are they worth?
People don't always do the rational thing.
Oh, they sure don't. You learn a lot about that in my line. Well, I guess you do in yours, too.
What was the part of Columbo like when you first read it?
It was very good. It was somebody that I immediately wanted to play. But the basic thrust of a guy appearing less than he actually is, that was always there.
Mm-hmm.
And that disarming quality of not ever appearing formidable was always there. I think that when we started to make the series, they would often write scenes that were supposed to be humorous. And those are the ones that made me very, very nervous.
Why?
Because I didn't think they were funny. They were kind of cute. And so I would tamper with those all the time to make sure that they were funny, that they were humorous, not funny, and that they were more subtle and more believable. And the other thing that I guess I insisted upon was that I think that he is by birth a polite man, but he's also canny. So he's not above using his politeness. But the fact that he is polite makes it easier for him to play polite. And the other thing that used to bother me about the early scripts, not the early scripts, any of the scripts, was in the final scene, if you had what actors used to refer to as Moshe the Explainer scenes. And that's when the detective, he takes 2 pages, he talks for 2 pages, and he explains everything that happened. And as the actor, you can hear the people snoring. You know the audience is tuned out, they're not interested. So the trick is to have that final scene remain a scene and have the cat and mouse going back and forth, and the audience plus the villain, they don't know what in the hell this guy's driving at, but they're interested. You show them just enough to keep them interested, keep them guessing what is he going to do, and when you finally nail the guy, that should be the end of the show. It should be about 3 lines after that, and that's it. It was things like that that used to... And clues. The clues can't be transparent. And if they're obvious to the audience, then he's not Sherlock Holmes.
And, of course, I should ask you about the raincoat, Columbo's raincoat, which I believe you bought.
Mm. Well, there was a dispute over that because I...
What, over who really bought it?
No, the dispute was... I always said that I read that in the script, but Lincoln Levinson said, no, it wasn't in the script. But I seem to remember seeing it in the script, so... Whatever it is, I did buy it, but I didn't buy it at the time. I had already had it, but I said, this is what I want to wear. And I knew what I wanted to wear underneath it, too. I wanted everything to be tan and brown altogether, a little dash of dull green in the tie. And that's about as flashy as he got. And the suit that fitted me the least was a seersucker, kind of seersucker blue and white. So I said, dye that. And they dyed it and got out all that white, whatever the hell it was, I don't remember. But it had to be dyed. And that became tan. And the shoes were mine, too. They were a pair of shoes I picked up in Italy, I don't know, a long time ago. They happened to be fairly expensive shoes, handmade shoes, but they were very comfortable, and they were clunky.
And that was important, clunky?
Clunky was important, yeah.
For that sense of being slightly uncoordinated?
I think you always wanted that contrast because the people that he was going after, they were always...
wealthy.
They were always, yes, God's chosen. I right. mean, they all had long necks, and they all could buy suits off the rack, and it fitted them, and they looked good, and Their teeth were white, and they had dough, and they spoke well, and so conky shoes were a good contrast.
I have one more Columbo question for you. Do you think that your long association with that character has worked for you, against you, both in your... in the other part of your career, the part outside of Columbia?
Well, I always say the same thing, Terry.
Say it again.
I'll say it again. Being known as Columbo, and it ain't cancer. So, I mean, I make a lot of dough, and the listeners, you know, I think it's difficult for the average person to say, what are you what's he complaining about that he's typecast? Who the hell cares? I mean, he does make a lot of money, and he gets good seats in restaurants, and so I don't feel that that's something that people are really interested in. But to answer your question, I think arguably I probably would be a better actor if I hadn't spent so much time playing that one role. I think that kind of diversity and that kind of challenge, I might be a better actor. I don't know. I'm not sure. I think probably I would be. But so what?
I want to ask you. You have a glass eye, and I think that happened when you were three. You had a tumor removed.
Yeah.
And I guess they removed your eye too.
It was a malignant tumor.
Do you think that that's that you've made that work for you as an actor to affect your image, to use it as something that looked menacing or that made you look more vulnerable?
Well, none of that was consciously. Mm-hmm. I mean, the only thing that I would be aware of when I was acting was a try to avoid looking 100% wall-eyed. I mean, so that if you were to look in one direction and one eye went all the way to the left and the other one was still in the middle, I try to avoid that. But I have never consciously felt it, though I'll use it in some way.
Geez, could you not get shot from certain angles because your eye wouldn't move and that would be the only eye on camera?
I'm better off from the left side. I think that minimizes the wall-eyed thing.
Mm-hmm. Did kids pay you to look? You know how kids are.
That would have been good. No, they never did that. Now, when you were a kid, you know, I used to dread that moment when somebody would say, what's the matter with your eye, or something like that. And there was a turning point, I don't know, when I was 12 or 13 years old. I think it had to do more with playing ball with the guys, because once you started knocking around with those guys, they were so open about it, and they would say it so freely, and it was usually a gag or a joke or knocking you or whatever the hell it is, that by then it didn't mean anything to me anymore. I was very comfortable with it.
Did it interfere with?
Because I realized the other thing is, then I realized I could get a laugh with it.
No, did it interfere with anything that you wanted to do?
No, not at all. No, I think one of the main problems with the eye was the fact that my mother would, if I'd go play football or whatever sport, she was always nervous about it. And I always thought that was ridiculous, nothing to be nervous about. You know, when you're that age, nothing can happen to you. And then you could always get people's attention if you took a spoon and tapped it.
Oh, gosh.
Well, the first night, I remember the first night I was in a Merchant Marine. There was this black guy from San Francisco. I think it was from Oakland. He didn't know me. I didn't know him. We just had shared this forecastle together for the first night, and he was sitting up in the top bunk opposite me, and I came in and I sat down. It was already very, very late, and he had his pajamas on, so I started getting undressed. At that time, I had my front teeth were knocked out, and I had a removable bridge, so I took out that bridge and put it on the table. It had a nice sound effect, a little clunk when that went down. And then I popped the eye out, and then the glass hit the tabletop. That had a nice sound effect. And he's up there. He's up there watching me. And then I bent over, and I started unscrewing my knee. It was a gesture, you know, where I started turning it. And it looked like I was about to remove my leg. And I'll never, I always remember him saying, excuse me, I'll be right back.
Peter Falk speaking with Terry Gross in 1995. The first season of Columbo has recently been released on DVD by Universal Home Video. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein on Kinsey. This is Fresh Air. In the new movie Kinsey, director Bill Condon, best known for the indie film Gods and Monsters, tackles the subject of Alfred Kinsey. In the 40s and 50s, Kinsey brought a scientist's zeal for pure research to the subject of human sexuality, both liberating and inflaming a culture that had defined normal sexuality very narrowly. Liam Neeson stars as Kinsey. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Morality disguised as fact. That's what Alfred Kinsey, played by Liam Neeson, calls sex education in the late 1930s. The phrase is incendiary even today, and it's the central motif of Bill Condon's Kinsey. Most biographical movies are spread out and superficial. They have no dramatic spine. But Condon's film is shaped by these four words. Morality disguised as fact warps the young Kinsey as it warped his puritanical father. It galvanizes the work of the scientist and the pioneer sex researcher, and it ultimately consumes the man. Condon's structure is incisive. The movie opens with the mature Kinsey drilling three of his research assistants in how to pose questions for a survey of sex habits, the survey that would involve thousands of subjects and form the core of his revolutionary study, Sexual Behavior in the Human Male and its female-oriented sequel. The point is to make the subject feel comfortable, because after all, people could easily be shamed when they talk, as they've never talked before, about how they masturbate, how they fantasize, how they have sex. The assistants practice by interviewing Kinsey, and one, played by Peter Sarsgaard, asks about his father, which prompts a look of panic and a flashback. Here is the adolescent Kinsey being bullied and shamed by his moralistic dad, played by John Lithgow, and then drilled in the danger to your brain if you touch yourself. And then a nice flourish. Condon puts his writer-director credit over a shot of young Kinsey in his sleeping bag, endangering his brain. Kinsey is not a masturbatory movie, though. It's broadly sympathetic while maintaining a clinician's detachment. From the beginning, as a researcher specializing in an insect known as the gall wasp, Kinsey fastens on the idea that individuals within species could show an infinite number of variations. In other words, there are no abnormal gall wasps, only millions of diverse little critters to be individually cataloged. You get a good idea what Clara McMillan, played by Laura Linney, is up against when she flirts with her reclusive professor.
Hello. Mind if I sit here?
Why?
Because you're the only unattached male, and I'm the only unattached female.
That's very sensible.
A man who cooks, how refreshing.
I picked it up when I went out west to collect galls. I was gone for 11 months, and I don't think I saw more than a dozen people the whole time.
Sounds lonely.
Oh, I enjoyed it.
I've been reading up on gall wasps. I think I know why they appeal to you.
Uh-huh.
They have great big wings, but they can't fly. They're incapable of getting from this hill to that hill unless it's close enough to walk, which means it's possible to retrace each generation's steps, hill by hill, by hill, by hill, all the way back to the very beginning. The gall wasp Garden of Eden.
That's very interesting, Miss Millen. You've managed to bridge the gap between Darwin and the Book of Genesis in a single phrase.
Macmillan.
Hmm?
Clara Macmillan.
Oh, I'm Proc.
Sorry?
It's a nickname my graduate students have given me. Professor K. Inzi. Proc. At first, I worried that it suggested an inappropriate level of intimacy between teacher and student that could lead to a loss of respect down the line.
I think it just means they like you.
Yes. Eventually, I realized that.
That's a delightful scene. It makes you laugh while it shows you how cut off Kinsey is from the human race. Neeson is very deft and very delicate at using his stature to suggest estrangement. He's Karloff's Frankenstein's monster with a PhD. This stunted giant resolves that humans are bigger, more complicated gall wasps. Jonathan Gaythorn Hardy, whose wonderful, chatty biography was a source for Condon's screenplay, writes that, quote, Kinsey felt he could only study sex by stripping away all but its physiological functions, first removing moral judgments, second, even harder, emotions and feelings. For both, he was ideally equipped psychologically, and for both, he was savagely criticized. What's inspiring about Kinsey is that it never streamlines this complexity. Its protagonist is a martyr to American moralism, unfairly denounced for insecticizing American womanhood by cataloging its practices, but also a selfish man whose steely exploration of his own bisexuality in the name of science takes a toll on his wife and colleagues. But if it's hard to like Kinsey when he watches, bemused, as a fight breaks out over wife swapping on his team, it's impossible not to share his joy as he wanders near the end among California redwoods with his loyal wife, enthralled by the enormity of the natural world. Kinsey is stupendously moving, with searching performances by Neeson, Linney, Lithgow, and Sarsgaard. Condon has the cheekiness to cast Tim Curry, Dr. Frankenfurter himself, as the voice of academic repression, the one who disguises morality as fact. It brings us full circle, for isn't Kinsey, in a way, the father of the man on woman, woman on monster, monster on man, pansexual utopia of the Rocky Horror Picture Show?
David Edelstein is film critic for Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Warner Home Video, presenting the four-disc collector's edition of Gone with the Wind, including a reproduction of the 1939 souvenir program. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Sideways is the new film by director Alexander Payne about two middle-aged men who set off on a week-long wine-tasting tour. One's a neurotic wine snob, the other is a dim-witted philanderer about to be married, looking for one last fling. On the next Fresh Air, we meet Rex Pickett, who wrote the novel on which the film is based. Join us for the next Fresh Air.